from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Jose Antonio Vargas joins us for this Forum segment, a former reporter for The Washington Post who shared a Pulitzer Prize for coverage of the Virginia Tech massacre. He's also worked for the San Francisco Chronicle and the Huffington Post and published an article last month in the New York Times titled My Life as an Undocumented Immigrant, in which he reveals his personal story of coming to America in 1993 at the age of 12 and, like thousands of so-called illegal immigrants, never gaining access to citizenship and having to find, thanks in his case to a number of friends and mentors, ways to achieve and thrive with the specter of being exposed always hanging over him. He joins us for this Forum segment, and we welcome you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Glad to have you. Well, 11 million illegals and undocumented, whatever we're calling them these days. In your case, though, I want to get your story here because it in some ways it's instructive and maybe not even atypical. In other ways, it is distinctive. You were here for a number of years, I believe 4 years. You wanted to get a driver's license. You went to the DMV with what you did not know was a fake green card.
All I knew going to the DMV was that I needed to bring some sort of card with me because my friend at the time was like, you can't just go there with your high school ID. You got to bring something with you. So I didn't tell my grandparents my mother sent me to live with them, her parents. And so I went to the DMV with my green card and my high school ID. And when I showed it to the woman in the booth at the DMV.
And this, we should mention, was here in Mountain View, wasn't it?
In Mountain View, yeah. Before Google got there. Yeah. And so I showed the woman my DMV, my green card, and she just looked at it and she flipped it around once. And I remember her like lowering and like kind of whispering and saying, you know, like, this is fake. Like, don't come back here again. And even to this day, I mean, I wonder what would have happened if she actually had like reported me.
Turned you in.
Turned me in.
You might be back in the Philippines, actually, where you came from. But
and then I rode my bike home, angry, confused. I mean, I just thought maybe she was lying. I figured maybe she was lying. And then when I got home and confronted my grandfather, you know, both my grandparents are American citizens. And so I just assumed that everything was fine. I'm one of those, they call it a mixed status family, when you have, you know, people in the family who are documented and people who are not. So that's when I found out when I was 16.
And now you've written about this whole experience and, you know, you've had a pretty distinguished career as a journalist. You've, in your own words, lived the American dream. I mean, success and Washington Post, New Yorker, those kinds of things, but always living in fear that you were going to be exposed. In fact, when you won the Pulitzer, weren't your grandmother's words to you, what if they find out?
So, yeah, when I won the part of the Pulitzer, you know, which was kind of a big deal for me, I mean, I remember her calling me because I guess she was getting a bunch of calls because it was all over Filipino news. And the first thing she said was, you know, what's going to happen if they find out? It wasn't even congratulations. It was, I mean, because it had been so much in her head. You know, I don't think there was a time that I left the house that she didn't feel like I was going to get caught at any moment. Which is why I think it's important to kind of note that I came forward with this story. It's not as if someone was threatening to out me or somebody was like saying that they were going to do an expose on me. No one knew.
This is the second time you've come out, well, so to speak. I mean, you came out first as a gay man and now you've come out.
But, you know, I think in many ways it's so quintessentially American.
Coming out?
I think it's what we do to each other. We come out to each other. I mean, you know, to be gay and to be undocumented is the reality for many people. And yet, when we come out, what are we really coming out to? We're coming out to people and hoping that they see the humanity in whatever that is. And that it's not going to matter that it's undocumented or gay.
If I may say so, your humanity comes across
thank you, sir.
Very fully in the article that you wrote. And your story is a very poignant one. Even going to the White House and being frightened and anxious about
it. I mean, I just remember being in Washington, D.C. for those 5 years and thinking to myself, I mean, it was like going through like – it was like having kerosene in my underwear the whole time because you're just thinking, you know, like what if I got assigned a story? I actually remember at one point I was covering – I was already a political reporter and they wanted to do a story on Mel Martinez being the first Hispanic chairman of the Republican National Committee.
And of Mel course Martinez being a senator from Florida.
Yeah, the senator from Florida. Yeah. And of course my name being Jose. Because, you know, in newsrooms, there's not a lot of people of color. So they're like, hey, Jose, maybe Jose can write about this. Never mind, by the way, that I'm not Hispanic. I'm Filipino, but, you know. So I went to actually interview Mel Martinez at the headquarters of the RNC. I had a good hour with him talking about the Republican candidates and their stance on immigration reform. And I swear to God, I was sitting there, that, you know, it was just the two of us. There wasn't even a press handler. At any point, I was afraid that I was just going to blurt it out. You know, like, hey, maybe you can help me out.
I feel like you're going to explode
it's so interesting because even so many of my friends who recently found out, many of them, I told them a week before the essay ran. No one knew. I mean, maybe two or three. And one of them said to me, Jose, dude, you're not that good a liar. I'm surprised it's just your eyebrows could have just like told it all. And I'm surprised you held it for as long as you did. And I'm like, yeah, me too.
Well, you mentioned being mistaken for Hispanic because your name is Jose, and Ruben Navarrete.
Oh, gosh, yes. Navarrete or Navarrete?
Navarrete,
yeah. I think, yes.
Well, I'm anglicizing, but I think he was upset, Hispanic Latino columnist.
Who's a good columnist.
He's a good columnist. He's been on this program, and I have respect for him. And, you know, he says essentially, you were lying, you should be deported. But in addition to that, he says, you've cast a black mark on journalists.
Oh, my God. That, I have to tell you, when journalists say that I've cast a black mark on journalism, as if I were the second coming of Jason Blair and Stephen Glass with some Janet Cook mixed in, it's just astounding to me. They can, you know, at the end of the day, I lied. And so I am in no position – I am in no position whatsoever to defend myself in that regard. I had to lie because I wanted to be in those newsrooms.
And to lie and break the law.
And break the law, yes. And I say that. You know, I've said that I mean, the whole article, the whole 4,300-word article was literally detailing, against the advice of my own lawyers, detailing in full what I had to do. Because back to your point, whatever it is that I did, it's just one person. I think in journalism, one of our jobs is to tell a story that illuminates a greater truth. And that's what I wanted to do with the piece.
And of course, Navarrete says, how can journalists be accepted as telling the truth when your life was a lie?
Exactly, which is a valid point. Now, that would be different if I were a columnist writing about my opinions and writing about my point of view. I wrote 650 articles, 98%, 99% of which have been factual reporting that – and again, this is where my fault with journalists is sometimes we don't do a good job reading. You know, I mean I would actually Facebook friended him after I saw that column. I Facebook friended Ruben.
Did he accept?
Oh, he accepted, which was great.
That's a nice ending to that story.
And then I sent him a note and I said, when you're ready to talk about a real, you know, when you get ready to actually talk about the real thing, let's go have a chat.
Is Phil Bronstein a friend of yours on Facebook too? Because I think he's quoted saying, Jose lied to me and everyone else he worked for, and that's not kosher, especially in a profession where facts and more elusively the truth are considered valuable.
Well, let me just say that Phil Bronstein, you know, I was hired as a full-time city desk reporter for The Chronicle while I was a senior at San Francisco State University. I owe him. He was the first person to give me a full-time job while I was still in college. So I'm forever indebted to him for that. And yes, I understand. Again, back to Ruben and Phil's point, I lied. I had to lie. I had to check boxes I wasn't supposed to check. And what's been interesting to me is
– about the response to
about
your article?
I mean, about the response from the media, mm-hmm. you know, from people in the media, which I expected. I expected that. I've been a journalist for 13 years. I know how this plays out, you know. But I was hoping that after they say he lied – and after they say, okay, can we trust him, then they can look at the articles and they can make that judgment. I was hoping that then we can move to the bigger issue of, so why did somebody like Vargas had to lie? What systems are in place so that when somebody who's 12, who then finds out when he was 16 that he's undocumented, who then tries to figure out, what do I do in this situation? I mean, back to your point, I'm so glad that you mentioned in the beginning, like if it wasn't for my principal and my superintendent at Mountain View High School, you know, who have been kind of my
– your underground railroad.
I've been referring to them with respect. I was actually a black studies minor at San Francisco State. So black history, African-American history is foremost in my mind. And I use underground railroad in the most respectful way that I can. If it wasn't for those people who somehow – decided to help me out, that there was the law And then there was a moral calling. And somehow within them, and again, when I was younger, I didn't know this because I was just like, they're helping me out. Great. Amazing. But as I got older and I realized just the consequences, like how they took these risks for me.
But you were also thinking when you were younger and even more recently that eventually this would come to the place where you could say, I'm a citizen of the United States, or things would change.
I was hoping. And, you know, in writing this piece, and I have to make this clear to people more and more so. I mean, I mentioned it in the article, but I had to ask for the permission of all these people in the piece to be named in full. You know, I didn't want to drag anybody into this mess that I'm in. You know, I was afraid.
I bet some of them were proud to have their names
yes,
in there,
but
they?
Some of them, like, you know, there's a man named Peter Pearl who was the director of newsroom and personnel at the Washington Post, who I told, you know, after 4 months of getting hired at the Washington Post, I started freaking out and I decided I'm going to go tell somebody. And I told Peter Pearl. And when I told him, and he's a senior manager there then and now at the Washington Post, I knew that I was putting him in a really uncomfortable position. And if he had said to me, you know, all right, let's go to Len Downey, the editor of the paper, and Don Graham, the CEO. Let's go there right now. And maybe I'd get deported right away or get fired right away. I was prepared for that. I was actually prepared more for that than I was when Peter Pearl said, all right, don't tell anybody. I won't tell anybody. We're in this together. Just prove yourself. That I wasn't prepared for. I was prepared for the other one.
Talking with Jose Antonio Vargas, his article, My Life as an Undocumented Immigrant, appeared in the June 22nd issue of the New York Times, and I'm going to open the phone lines and invite you to join this conversation, you who are listening, that is. Our listeners, it's toll-free, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. We'd like to hear from you. It's 866-733-6786, and again, we do welcome your calls to 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or you can, of course, post a question or comment on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and click on the segment. I know that you were disappointed that this didn't lead to, or hasn't led yet, we'll say, to a broader conversation about things like the DREAM Act and about all the number of people who are here who would like to have found opportunities, or paying their taxes, et cetera. And
yeah,
would like
as
to.
I've been paying my taxes all these years.
But, you know, you put yourself out there, and there was a good deal of courage in that because they may deport you. You know, there may be real consequences. But I'm wondering about when you get somebody like, again, Ruben saying, hey, he's going to get a book deal out of this. He's going to get big speaking fees out of this
exactly.
and everything.
No, I read that too.
Yeah, how do you reckon?
Well, what's interesting is, so I profiled Mark Zuckerberg for The New Yorker last year, which was a really great achievement for me just because The New Yorker was like my Bible, right? After that, I was actually already preparing to do a book on a constitution for the digital age. I was getting ready to sell a book called Clickocracy, One Nation Under Google with Video and Email for All, a constitution for the digital age. So whether or not I write a book, I was going to do that anyway. And that's not what this is about, although I also have to worry about I'm unemployable. I am literally unemployable right now. And when I decided to do this, I knew that I couldn't be employed. That's why I left everybody. I left Arianna Huffington by last summer, Huffington Post. I've been independent and freelancing all these months before I came out. But to that point of I basically got 5 more years when I got my second driver's license in Washington State earlier this year. And for a good month there, I actually thought, okay, I have 5 more years. So maybe I'll just keep writing these lucrative magazine profiles that pays good money, and I'll just live in the shadow and I'll just do that. And I'll be comfortable in my apartment in New York, and I'll just keep, you know, whenever I get asked to do a foreign trip, I'll just say, I'm sorry, I don't like traveling across the Atlantic or something like that. But at the end of the day, my story is just one story. And what's been fascinating is hearing thousands, you know, literally actually hundreds of people emailing us on defineamerican.com, this organization that we've started, this project that we've started. Because I think, again, what the article has done is speak to the bigger truth of what undocumented people in this country have to live through.
Why defineamerican.com and not defineamerica.org?
Well, we wanted – are you familiar with the It Gets Better campaign?
No.
It's about basically kind of an anti-gay bullying video series that's about, you know, gay people and straight people saying it gets better as you get older. Don't worry, right?
Well, I have heard some.
Yes, exactly. And so we really kind of wanted to replicate this idea of one story comes many other stories, right? And this this idea of defining what an American is, what an American means to you. And by the way, you can both go to defineamerican.org or .com. We actually bought both URLs. But it's about how you define American, whether or not you're undocumented or documented. So we wanted to ask that question. We're actually going to be rolling a video feature the next month or so.
Bring these together, actually, with an email here. I'm just looking at an email from a listener. Michael says, wondering whether the guest feels his difficult, problematic coming out process as a young gay man influenced aspects of his decision to live a closeted, undocumented adult life. Did less than an ideal family acceptance become a catalyst to avoiding further rejection?
I mean, it's interesting because my family, my Filipino family...
At first, your grandfather was very rejecting of your gay coming out.
I actually think some members of my Filipino family, I can't speak for all of them, are probably more uncomfortable about the fact that I've come out as openly gay to the world in that article than me coming out as an undocumented immigrant, which is interesting from a cultural perspective, right? I mean, there's tons of, you know, I mean, African-American community, the Hispanic community, the Asian community, being openly gay is just a big – it's something that we don't like to talk about. So there's that. But I think for me, actually, I recently have been speaking to some of my classmates in high school. I came out during first period U.S. history class, and there were like 30 kids in the room. And I've been hearing from all these classmates that I had back then who were like writing me saying, well, we thought you like came out already. This is a whole other thing, Jose. How did you hide this? Because, you know, in high school, I couldn't drive. I didn't have a license, right? So I was like driving Miss Daisy in high school. Everybody drove me around. So now it made sense to people. They're like, oh, that's why you couldn't drive. That's why everybody, the principal was driving you around.
So the listener says, does Mr. Vargas know why his grandparents did not make use of their own citizenship status to sponsor their grandson to get a resident alien status?
Well, again, this is where the labyrinth, complicated, and in many ways archaic immigration laws are
and
so unknown
impossibly
to people.
Bureaucratic.
Yes, impossibly bureaucratic. Grandparents are not allowed. It's not – they can't adopt. They can't petition a grandson. They can only petition their married children, but they can petition them after they become citizens, not before that. And the waiting list and the years that it takes, 10 years, 12 years, 15 years. We're not talking like a six-month waiting period like you have something in layover at a Walmart. Like,
yeah, you were told fairly early on you have to go to the Philippines for 10 years,
right? 10 years and come back.
And then you can come back, maybe.
Maybe.
Let me find out what our listeners have to say here, and we'll go to your calls. We'll begin, Todd, with you. Good morning. You're on the air, Todd.
Hey, good morning. I think you have a very touching story, Mr. Vargas, and you commented earlier about the fact that you were waiting for the conversation to change into what you were just now talking about, the waiting room, the waiting list, the difficulties. But I'm embarrassed to say this, but it seems to me that the conversation should be, why are you still here? I mean, you keep using the word undocumented instead of the actual word, which is, you're an illegal immigrant. And I've had dishwashers that have worked for me in restaurants, and it broke my heart when ICE came to take them away. But I understood that that was the law. Why are you still here?
Why am I still here? Well, thank you for calling in, by the way. Why am I still here? Well, when I decided to do this, of course, I had to prepare myself from whatever the legal consequences are. So I've definitely looked through those. And knowing that I have to be prepared for anything and everything that can happen, why am I still here is really something that I can't answer. That's something that the government has to answer. And at the end of the day, you know, I'm one of 11 million undocumented immigrants in this country.
But you've made yourself somewhat
exactly.
more conspicuous. I mean, there are people who
definitely.
Say, I'm not going to pay taxes because I don't believe constitutionally I have to pay taxes. And the IRS goes after them, right?
Well, but just by the way, last year, undocumented immigrants in this country paid $11.2 billion in state and federal taxes.
Yeah, I was just using that as an analogy.
But I mean, something that's something that we don't talk about because the narrative is undocumented immigrants are taking
entitlements. Right.
But back to his point about why I keep referring to myself as an undocumented versus illegal, because I am thinking, as I was when I was, you know, in high school, I'm thinking of the kids who are even younger than I am in middle school, you know, in middle schools across, you know, the Bay Area, sitting there and thinking when somebody uses the word illegal, this is illegal immigration. Let's not get politically correct about that. This is illegal immigration. But for the kid that is sitting there, for me to say that he is illegal or she is illegal, no human being is illegal. No human being is illegal.
It's just that word, a signifier.
As a gay person, it's like calling me the F word, right? I mean, at the end of the day, and you know, this is, I don't want to get so like Whole Foods politically correct here, but at the end of the day, words matter. And I don't want any of these kids ever to think that they're that illegal person.
Let me get another caller on here, and we'll go to you next. Chris, you're on.
Yes, I'm a dual citizen and could live either here or in France, but underlying this whole discussion is the implication that being a great journalist in the Philippines would be being condemned to hell. I mean, obviously it's a lot more complicated because you're an out gay person, and I think that's a lot easier in the United States than in the Philippines. But it's not like the entire 10 billion people on the planet can live in the United States.
Oh, yeah, of course.
So why not be a journalist in the Philippines, I think, is an implication.
Oh, yeah, it's the implication. And, of course, you know, people are going to read into the article what they're going to read into it. I mean, that's certainly not my intention for people to think that the worst thing in the world is to be a working journalist. I'm a journalist, you know, like I can kind of work wherever I need to work. But beyond that, I graduated from middle school in Crittenden, went to Mountain View High School, went to San Francisco State University. My life is here. I've been paying taxes since I was 17. I've tried to live the best that I could. And I'm one of just 2 million undocumented kids under the age of 30 in this country. I consider myself an American and I consider this my home. I would love to be able – I haven't seen my mother since I was – I mean, you talk about being a dual citizen. That's great. That's amazing. I haven't seen my mother since I was 12. It's 18 years next month. I just want to be able to kind of see her. And this is another point, is that, you know, she has tried to get a tourist visa to get to the States and visit me. But that process, you know, she's not a college – you know, she didn't graduate from college, right? So people in countries like the Philippines are not allowed to just get a tourist visa because people fear in this country, and rightfully so, that they may just overstay and never leave.
There's also been a great concern since 9/11 because there
is – Of course.
Well.
Exactly.
Let me thank the caller, and we'll move on to more of your calls here, and we'll go to Berkeley. And Mark, you're our next caller. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning. I'm just like to congratulate the speaker in there. I'm myself an illegal immigrant. I'm here in the States for 12 years now. I'm a businessman. I got my own business, paid my tax for 12 years. And since the Dream Act and the last immigration reform did not pass, I became disappointed. But I got my family back in Brazil. Everybody I didn't see for 12 years. My grandmother died 2 years ago. I wasn't able to go to her funeral in there because I'm illegal. And it's kind of frustrating to pay the taxes and think you are. We are considered American citizens. We pay taxes. We create jobs. We pretty much contribute for this country and not be able to be considered as American citizens.
I think that says it from your point of view too, doesn't it?
Well, thank you for calling. I appreciate that.
Listener named Xavier, or Javier, I'm sorry, he says, I listened to your interview on Fresh Air and I was thoroughly impressed. That is, until you started talking about your support for the Dream Act, you kept repeating, quote, positive contribution to society and you lost me. That goes against the foundation of this country. All people are created equal. Why should a university student get precedence over a mechanic, farm worker, domestic, etc.?
Well, that's a really good point. And you know, certain journalists have been pressing me on certain pieces of legislation. And I think what's really important to note is what we've started with DefineAmerican.com that kicked off the day that the essay was published online was that we're looking to elevate and reframe this conversation more than any policy point. At the end of the day, you know, it was actually President George Bush that gave the first ever primetime speech on immigration on like May 16th, 2006. And he was the man that said, we're a nation of laws and we're a nation of immigrants. How do we find the rational middle ground? 5 years has gone by. We have yet to go back to that rational middle ground. Meanwhile, the Obama administration has deported, what, nearly a million people in this country. Dream Act kids, and again, back to his point.
Although Obama has spoken very sympathetically about these kids.
But he also realizes that if he is going to come to people and say, you know, I am for comprehensive reform, he's got to be able to say, but I've been tough. I've been enforcing the laws. We've been trying to enforce the laws. We've been securing the border.
He's also got to get Congress behind him.
Of course. That's a whole other issue right there.
It is indeed. And let me get some more calls on. Ann, thank you for joining us. Welcome.
Thank you. I read Mr. Vargas's article at the same time that he got a full scholarship to San Francisco State. I was applying to the same college to get a teaching credential. I earned about $9,000 a year and had two children to support. But, of course, I didn't get a scholarship. I didn't get enough money to be able to do it. I couldn't have gone into debt. There was no way to pay to live. You know, I would have had to have quit my job. So I just continued in my low-paid job. And, of course, you know, for a long time needed things like Medi-Cal and so forth to survive. In general, you know, scholarships, internships, jobs at prestigious journalism outfits are extremely limited goods.
And forgive me, but we're limited in time here, too. And right. I want to get Mr. I think we got the gist of your call. I want to get Mr. Vargas's response to that. I mean, you got money. She didn't get money.
Yeah.
She needed it. I don't know how much you needed it. But
I'm not supposed to be here. Right?
You're not supposed to be here. Exactly.
So,
yeah.
And ma'am, I completely understand and sympathize with your point. And one of the things that I had to always wrestle with when I was younger was, am I taking somebody else's spot? Am I taking somebody else's job? And I would post those questions to my superintendent and my principal and actually the guy who started the scholarship fund. By the way, the scholarship fund is not through San Francisco State. The scholarship fund was a fund that a venture capitalist in the Bay Area started up for kids and families who had never gone to college. And the scholarship fund didn't care what your immigration status was. They just didn't ask. So that's how I got the scholarship. But what's been, I guess, for me, what's been incredibly helpful is all of a sudden my principal and my superintendent – I remember when I called my principal when I got the Washington Post internship. Because, you know, there's like 20 spots, hundreds of kids apply, you know, from Princeton, Harvard, or whatever. And I'm like, am I taking somebody's spot? And Pat Hyland, my principal, laughs at me. Jose, it's not as if somebody just gave this to you. You worked hard in your own way to get this.
He was right. But you also took someone else's spot.
Yes. Yeah. Well,
we're going to have to end on that note. Jose, thank you for being here.
Thank you
us.
For having me.
Jose Antonio Vargas, again, you can read My Life as an Undocumented Immigrant in the June 22nd New York Times issue. I thank you for being with us this first hour of Forum, another hour coming your way. We're going to talk about looting of museums, particularly the Getty Museum, with the co-author of Chasing Aphrodite. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, and Tina Lauberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.